Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. This week, I am talking to Overflow Games, who are currently, at the time of this recording, finishing up work on their next game. That's Cornerstone, The Song of Tirim. And they're here to talk about their studio and their game. Please welcome, from the studio, Samuel and Jonathan.
Hey.
Hey guys, it's great to have you on the cast today.
Thanks for having us.
So, to get the ball rolling then, since this is both your guys' first time here on the cast, could you talk a little bit about your backgrounds and how Overflow Games got started?
Sure. Like, me and Sam has basically known each other since we were like small kids. Mm-hmm. So, like, growing up, we always were interested in, like, games and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, in, I think we were, like, around 14, 15 there, we started making, like, small stuff, like, for games. And from there on, like, we were able to, like, make more and more advanced stuff. Mm-hmm. And then that's the route that we were taking together. Sam?
Yeah, I guess like that was during like high school. We made a couple of like smaller things that never really went anywhere. But then I guess a year or so after high school, we discovered Kickstarter all of a sudden. And we were like, oh, maybe we can like make something that people would be interested in helping us develop. Because it seemed like a perfect opportunity. So we worked on like the first, I guess, prototype of Cornerstone for maybe half a year or something, and then we made a Kickstarter, and it failed actually the first time. But we didn't give up because I wouldn't say we were very close, but we were close enough to have like hope. So we worked on it for another 6 months and used everything that we had learned during this first Kickstarter.
The goal of the Kickstarter, like we were close of getting the final amount that we needed to finish the Kickstarter.
So yeah, eventually the second Kickstarter, we scraped over the finish line, and that's basically when we started Overflow. Okay. Guess, do you want to know anything about what we made before Cornerstone, or is it of no interest? I don't know.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Are you at all interested in what we made before Cornerstone, or should we start with?
Okay. Yeah, sure, since we're just doing introductions right now, that's fine.
Yeah, sure. So, I guess the first game we actually finished and like uploaded to the internet was like 2D. We always made 3D, but it was like 2D,
2.5D puzzle game
perspective. Yeah, so you could teleport to different light sources. So like even back then, I remember when I was like I guess we were 16 or something. Then I was kind of at that point tired of combat, and I was like really impressed by Portal, so I was like really gung-ho on making a puzzle game, so we decided to go that direction, and we uploaded it, and it got a few people liked it, so like we were encouraged to keep going.
But there weren't really like any real noise about it, so like we just uploaded it, and then like, that was it, basically.
Is it still on the internet, Jonathan? Should we just mention? Yeah, we called it. Was it called Ascension?
yeah, first time, and then we uploaded again because we noticed that we got the most views in the beginning, so we uploaded again, and we called it "So You Think You Can Blink."
Mm-hmm. And after that, we tried to make an endless runner like everyone else. Unfortunately, it looked like the perfect things to do. So we made this little endless runner for
smartphone game.
Yeah, for both Android and I called the Billy Puffer. You kind of guide this fish with your finger, and he has to like avoid obstacles, and he's like chased by these different monsters and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And after that, that's when we decided to make Cornerstone, which was like, even from the beginning, it was like the ambitious dream game we had always had in mind.
Exactly.
All right. So with Cornerstone, then, this was your guys' first actual Kickstarter project, right?
Yeah. This was our first bigger project, too. Like, the Eiffel game was, like, a 1 or 2 month project. So, this was our first, like, ambitious thing.
Okay. Now, I guess, as you just said, The original Kickstarter did fail. You guys were close to it, and you decided to do it again.
Yeah.
Now, normally when we hear about these Kickstarter projects, especially most of the members of the industry enthusiasts, it's usually a one-and-done deal. Either the game finishes, the Kickstarter, everyone gets the game, or if it fails, most people just hear that, you know, the game just either gets made some other way or it just doesn't get done. Now, for you guys, what did you learn from the first Kickstarter to sort of apply to the second one for people listening to the cast?
Like, first off, the first version of the game for the first Kickstarter was pretty horrible when we look back at it. Visually and like gameplay wise, and like it was just really a vague idea, and we just like talked about how much we like physics in games, and then we tried to like make something look like a game from that.
I guess we could say we did everything wrong, basically. So there's no like
basically,
there's
yeah.
no specific thing we messed up, but we had no idea what we were doing, so we did everything wrong, but we learned a lot. So like the second time we made it, kind of. And like the timing is also important, because Kickstarter goes in waves. Like, we were kind of right at the end of the first bubble, because in the beginning, like, everything got funded, but then people got like disillusioned with it, and nothing got funded except if we were really credible. So we were lucky with the timing as well on the second one.
Yeah,
like the first one didn't deserve to get funded, like objectively. So we couldn't really be disappointed. We just didn't have any perspective back then.
Yeah, from this perspective, it's even good that the first one didn't get made, because like we didn't know much at all about like how to make games or something, anything like that. Like, so, yeah, this size, at least.
It was mostly a quality thing, I'd say. And I guess marketing, like we reached out to, we had like done some like Tumblr posts and things like that, but we're better at timing our promotion, I guess, the second time around too.
Yeah. That's also one, like a big difference between the first and the second Kickstarter, because the second one, we were building up this like fan base, if you will, from like just posting stuff, because we realized we never did that with the first one. We just posted a game and we were hoping for it to be like funded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things I do hear from a lot of developers who have been doing Kickstarter, especially after, as you were just saying about the bubble bursting, that it's a lot more important these days to build a community, get people engaged with the project, even before you do the Kickstarter.
We've seen
developers spend, you know, months doing promotional campaigns, getting things right, so that when they do launch, everyone, one, their fans know about, so they're going to send the information out, and two, they will hopefully have, you know, the press interested, so they can get that much needed bump from, you know, any major game sites and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like the odds of getting a major game site is pretty small, unless you get hit that critical mass. But you can always get some like mid-tier.
And most games that get funded right now is also like pretty far into development. Like,
yeah,
they're pretty like big vertical slices, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just like expand on it based on how much money they get. But we were like nowhere with Cornerstone. We just like build stuff in a couple of weeks, and then we just try to show people.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the second Kickstarter now for Cornerstone, and I don't think Kickstarter has the copy of the first one saved, but it does look like a very well put together Kickstarter. You have all the details you need, you have the stretch goal, story, what makes the game unique, etc., etc. Yeah. And these are all important parts, and of course, most importantly, you actually have a video, you actually have multiple videos of how the game looks. And I think that is one part that's becoming incredibly more important, especially in today's market. You can't get by with just saying, I want to make a great game, and have like nothing to show people.
Unless you have credibility.
Like, yeah.
Double Fine kind of did that, but they have credibility, so yeah, they managed to do it anyways.
Mm-hmm. And even then, they've been having some trouble with having repeated successes. While Broken Age was a massive hit, they've had trouble, I guess, getting to that same amount of funding with stuff like Master Chalice, and, of course, Space-Based DF9 didn't work out too well for them. So the market has definitely cooled, I think, in some cases, on Kickstarters. It's still possible to get your games funded and make a lot of money. It just requires a lot more effort and a lot more insight into crowdfunding these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bar is higher.
Yeah, definitely. Now, with Cornerstone itself, I was looking at it. I tried a little bit of the early access version a few days before this recording, and the game definitely has like a different feel to it. For people who haven't heard of Cornerstone before, could you talk a little bit about what the game is about?
Like narratively or gameplay wise?
Let's start with narrative and then we'll move into gameplay.
Yeah, like the narrative is like you start up on an island, on a Viking island. You're a small Viking boy. And then you realize that all the men in the village has gone away. And you don't really know where to. Mm-hmm. And that's basically like just the start point of the game. And then like your goal in the game is to find the men and figure out what happened to them. So like the game doesn't have like a lot of narrative in it. It's more like of a, branching, you go from like point to point and then there's like just like gameplay in between. So you kind of have to find.
Yeah, I'd say like there's different islands and they all have their own cultures and like, it's minor storylines. So it's a classic action adventure in that way, I'd say. But we haven't really focused on, there's no Game of Thrones like deep lore or anything. We have like our own little universe we created, but it's not the focus of the game. It's not an RPG in that way.
Mm-hmm. And
it's like the story unfolds by like minor cutscenes and like conversations with the characters.
Okay. Now the big like twist of the game, what makes it different from other titles, I know you guys are focusing a little bit more on like crafting elements and more of the open world gameplay compared to more traditional action adventure games and stuff like that.
That was one of the main goals from the very beginning, to make a game that is like that you would be able to play in a lot of different ways. And that's also the main reason we created the crafting system, because the crafting system is there to like get you by in your kind of way, basically. Mm-hmm. So like you could either hang glide or you could blow that up with a boom barrel, or you could like blow some bandit up with like a mine that you placed on beforehand.
Yeah, and we wanted to streamline the game, so like every item you find is like useful in multiple situations. You don't like carry a bunch of crap that you never use. So there isn't even an actual inventory in the game. There's just the crafting system, which has a different, where you find different recipes, I guess you call them. That's one of the unique things, I guess. And the second one is like we tried to, in the beginning, like we said, we were really into like physics. Like I guess a big inspiration other than was like Half-Life 2, you know, like it really blew our minds the first time we played, but no games after that really focused on it. At least it's not the ones we were playing. So we tried to reintroduce that as much as possible, but we realized it was really hard to make like physics puzzles and whatnot. So we kind of pulled that back a bit. There's still a lot of like interactivity with physics, but it's not like the main focus of the game anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're trying to build a game around multiple solutions, multiple ways to play it, that's always been one of like the trickiest parts of world design, because it's always a challenge to create something that people will be able to figure out versus something that only the developers will know about. We've seen this a lot in the adventure genre with crazy esoteric puzzles. How did you guys approach, like, what was like your overall philosophy in terms of building the challenges to say that, okay, you can do it this, this, and this way, as opposed to saying, oh, you can only do it this way?
Like, basically, just like iterations. Like, we went back to places multiple times to make sure that, like, that you could go through this in like multiple different ways. Like, not every instance is like that you would be able to like go in like different ways, but we tried to do it as much as possible.
We tried to think of like two or three ways that you could do it, and then there's usually a way that we haven't even thought of. So like if we could figure out three ways, that was enough kind of, then we trusted like there would be even more ways if people would get creative. But there's no like perfect way of doing it. You just have to like, it's every puzzle is hard. It's harder if you have multiple solutions.
Yeah.
There's no way around it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at the tagline on the Kickstarter. You guys said Wind Waker meets Dark Souls. So obviously, there's some level of combat, because you can't have a passive Dark Souls experience. There's no such thing. Now, obviously, with combat being a second part of the game, or a second cornerstone of the design, how does that fit into playing Cornerstone?
Like the combat, we tried to make like a more simplified Dark Souls kind of combat system. We have like the targeting thing that the Dark Souls has, and like Wind Waker has it also, but like it's a little bit more like floaty in a way in ours as it is in like Dark Souls. But it's for being a first game, it's really hard to make this like kind of dynamic combat system that is in Dark Souls. So like when I look at back at it, like it was kind of a desperate move to get as much attention as possible, even though Dark Souls and Wind Waker were big influences on this game.
In retrospect, we wouldn't have used that line. Like when we were making the game, we were super into Dark Souls at the time, but it would be fair to like compare it at all at this stage. So
yeah. We were pretty naive too. We thought that we could create like our dream game without issues at all. Mm-hmm. But then later on, we realized that we had to compromise some.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's always one of the biggest challenges of game development. Most, like 9 times out of 10, your original vision will never survive completely through iteration to the final release.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it makes you humble. It makes you respect games like the Soul series a lot more. Mm-hmm. Like every decision they've made is like you have so much more respect for it when you've actually tried to make it yourself.
Yeah.
But it's like for Cornerstone, I had never made a humanoid animated character before. And then now we just choose to make like 4 different cultures with like bandits and this like complicated combat system kind of.
Yeah. And that is just one of like, the more interesting points of game development that I know a lot of the mainstream audience never really hears about or knows because it's never really talked about, but there is a lot of work that goes into making these games. And I always get like a little chuckle when I read on forum saying, why don't you just add in one more level? Or can you make a new enemy? It can't be that hard to do that. And you always know the difference between someone who's looked at game development and someone who hasn't by those types of questions.
And then there's this House of Card effect where like everything you add can eventually end up breaking the whole game if you're not careful. So you have to be really careful about adding new stuff after the fact.
Oh yeah, definitely. On previous podcasts here, we've talked about this idea of almost a harmonizing game design where everything fits together, nothing seems like it was just added for the sake of having it, and you know, everything just works off of your core foundation. And whenever you have to add in new systems or new design into like later mid to late into game development, as you were just saying, it's pretty much a House of Cards effect. If something doesn't work or something messes something else up, you can just feel that or see that just hit every aspect of your game. And a lot of the titles that don't work that well in the market are those that it just feels like someone just like stitched together different game mechanics and design and said, okay, here's a finished game, enjoy, kind of deal.
Yeah. It's true.
Now, with Cornerstone, as you're talking about with like the crafting system and the multiple solutions for puzzle solving, I guess my question then is, with crafting, like what can like the player actually craft? Like, are they able to just craft from like a pre-created list of items and tools, or do they have some kind of personalization or means of maybe altering items slightly, maybe giving something an additional effect or something along those lines?
No, like the things that you can craft are like pretty much pre-made by us. Mm-hmm. But you can craft a pretty wide variety of items that help you in different ways. So like you can craft like a hang glider, as we call it. Mm-hmm. And that will like slow down your fall and you be basically a hang glider. Yeah. But you can also craft your own armor, but that armor is always the same every time you craft it. But it just like we wanted to keep it simple in a way. So like you there's two different kind of armors. So there's one that is a little bit lighter that breaks easier, and then we have like a heavier armor that takes more damage, but it's also more expensive to build. Like we don't have like more differences than that in a way. But all the weapons and things that you use in the game, you're crafting as well.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of like finding new stuff or progression, is it mainly limited to finding new recipes that you can then use to craft that gear?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, and I guess like the classic health upgrade and whatnot. But there's no like there's no in-depth RPG system other than that. It's like the crafting and increased health and stamina. But I guess, there's no other RPG system.
All right. Now, another tagline I saw on the site was obviously we just said about the Wind Waker themes and the idea of sailing around. Now, how are you guys doing that differently compared to other games?
Well, I don't know if there are a lot of other sailing games, but like we decided Erland would just be, it was a nice, we liked the idea of having separate islands.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to go with that. And then eventually, like, even in Wind Waker though, like it eventually gets annoying if you have to sail back and forth all the time. So we decided to add fast travel to make it simpler, but like,
mm-hmm.
It's just a way of like separating the world in a more interesting way than just having a teleportation loading time.
Mm-hmm.
There's not like, we didn't have time to add like a bunch of crazy gameplay on the ocean, unfortunately, but you don't have to do, the only sailing you do is from one island to another. After that, you can always fast travel.
Okay. Now, I guess another question I have for you guys about Cornerstone. I was looking at the Kickstarter, and you talked about boss design and trying to do things differently compared to other games, making them more strategic and puzzle-like as opposed to just meat walls. So you just have to keep attacking for 20 minutes to kill them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since you guys went with a different route in terms of the philosophy of like, the world building with the different puzzles and their solutions, how did you, I guess, go about designing your bosses for the game?
You can still use, like, you can still use all your crafting while you're playing against a boss. Mm-hmm. So we always had in mind to make the bosses vulnerable to multiple things and not just have this, like, one thing.
One weakness.
Yeah, one weakness thing. Mm-hmm. And then we just, like, we made just a base for the boss, and then we kind of, like, evolved that into something that would be vulnerable to multiple things.
But it's up to the player to experiment. Because, like, you can either, like, hit them with a weapon, or you could, like, pick up a chair and throw it at them, or you can
craft back a bomb thing and throw it at them, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
yep. Were you about to say something?
No.
And boss design is another very interesting element. We talked a few minutes ago regarding the Soul series, and that's a series that is just pretty much designed around creating as many out-of-control boss fights as you can, and out-of-control in the sense that you really need to have high skill to beat them. I mean, I could spend the next hour detailing all my Soul boss fight experiences.
Yeah.
Now, another part of Cornerstone, like, in terms of its actual development, we talked about the Kickstarter side earlier, but obviously the game is on Steam. You guys are currently... Now, is the game currently available in Early Access, or is that simply for people who crowdfunded it at the moment?
No, now it's only... Now, the only thing available, like, officially, mm-hmm. both for both Kickstarter backers and others, is the... demo that we have on Steam right now,
which is the first island of the game, more or less.
But we have had a lot of like backers helping us with like testing and stuff like that. So like some of them have played the real game if they wanted to.
Okay, yeah. So I see you have the demo, then you have the actual game. Oh, yeah, like the actual listing, but that's not available just yet. So yeah. On the Kickstarter site, you obviously were able to get onto Greenlight. Was that right? You were able to pass the Greenlight program?
Yeah.
Oh. Pretty easily, actually.
Yeah, we did the Greenlight during the Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And that went through like in 2 days or something, I think.
Now, for people like myself who haven't done really much with Greenlight or enthusiasts listening, how was like the overall like Greenlight process as a developer?
It's changed a lot. Like back then, it was the bar was higher, I think, to get in. But now, well, I think the base cost is like $100 or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe less. I don't remember. And then you can upload as many games as you want. Mm-hmm. But you just have to like try to drive traffic to your Greenlight site and hope you get in within the top 100. Mm-hmm. And then eventually Steam will greenlight you. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a lottery, but
yeah. But Steam, Steam Greenlight crowd actually does a lot on its own compared to like Kickstarter. Kickstarter is very limited; like you really have to bring your own crowd in there. Mm-hmm. But like Greenlight has like basically a more like a bigger crowd already there. So like we were pretty amazed by how much we got from just Greenlight.
Yeah, and I guess we were lucky too. We had like a mainstream genre, like action adventure is a genre that a lot of people play. I guess if you have like a more niche puzzle game or something.
Yeah, but we have posted other games in Greenlight as well.
Yeah, but I'm saying like if you have a niche game, even if it's good quality, it might be hard to get greenlit because people just are honest when they say they wouldn't buy it. Mm-hmm. So yeah. The genre really affects, the quality in the genre affects how fast you get greenlit. Mm-hmm. So it is really a popularity contest and nothing else. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say. But if you already have an audience, then you can probably get greenlit pretty easily. You just have to make them vote and it's done.
But still, even if the Greenlight audience is big, you should always like bring your own audience in there to boost it up. Because otherwise it could take really long before you get greenlit.
Yeah, and as you said, you guys did it during the actual Kickstarter for Cornerstone. So you had the buzz from the Kickstarter to sort of help influence people to go to the Greenlight.
Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really good strategy on your guys' part. Because again, if you guys will wait until after the Kickstarter, you know, sometime during mid-development when all that buzz will have faded, I think it probably would have been a lot harder to get that. Because as you're just saying, it can be some of a lottery. You know, whoever's the most popular, has like the most tickets, obviously has the best chance of getting in.
Yeah.
Now,
but I'd say it's a lot easier now. Like the bar is pretty low than back then.
Oh,
it used to be really hard. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. That's one of the things we've been hearing some complaints about with Steam is the fact that the quality control has really went down. I think since they really adopted the early Greenlight program, we've seen complaints of people seeing, you know, games with like maybe like 10 seconds of like gameplay get greenlit or stuff like that. I think there's a post on Gamasutra like a few weeks ago where someone said they literally passed a game about watching paint dry through the Greenlight program simply because they were able to find an exploit in it.
Yeah,
it baffles me. I don't know.
Yeah.
They'll have to do something eventually, I guess. I mean, they disappear from the store page, but they do cause trouble, I guess. I mean, they make Steam look bad, so it's not a good thing.
Yeah, it becomes a little bit like the Android compared to like how iOS market is.
Yeah,
like Android market is so cluttered with so many like very raw, like rough games.
Yeah,
I guess iOS has that too at this point, but you never see them the same way you do on Android.
Yeah, but like there's still a bigger commitment to go get into the iOS market because you have to like pay annually instead of like the Google Play. You have to play, like you pay once and then you can post as much as you want.
So like having some threshold is always good, we would say.
Exactly.
Yeah. And having some level quality control I think is a big deal, especially for Steam, and something that I think we may have to start seeing more of. Because again, there are so many games being released daily on the platform that it's really hard for someone to get, you know, into one game before they see 5 or 10 other games out there. And that kind of market overflow has been causing some issues with indie developers, with getting their name out there. And of course, you know, the importance of like that first week of sales, that first week of publicity, can be critical for a lot of studios.
Okay. Yeah, it really increases the importance of like having your own audience from the beginning, I guess.
Yeah.
So you can like get over that threshold of visibility.
I think also like the early access causes a lot more games to be like published, announced on Steam as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And it also increases the amount that you have to fight against. Mm-hmm.
And I think having your own fan base, again, is a really big deal. It's why it's so important to cultivate your fans before, during, and after the whole Kickstarted and crowdfunding experience. Because you want these people to be, singing the praises of your games, letting people know about it. Because, I mean, it's essentially free publicity. And for smaller studios, hell, for any studio, that's pretty much worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
Now, I guess to start to wrap things up, let me do a quick check over here. I'll do a quick pause right now. I don't think there's any other topic, at least from my point of view. I think we've hit everything about in terms of Cornerstone. Have any other topics come up or anything that you guys have been thinking of that you would like to like bring up on the cast next?
Nothing that I could think of.
All right. Was there anything relating to Cornerstone that I miss or didn't bring up that you guys would like to talk about?
I don't think so. Okay. No.
I think we're good.
All right. We'll get back to it. I think I just have a few general wrap-up questions, and then we'll probably start to say goodbye. All right.
Okay.
3, 2, 1. Yeah, with the whole crowdfunding path from Kickstarter to Steam, either through Early Access or Greenlight, the process itself has certainly become more and more important. I guess as a very interesting question, one that I've been asking a lot more developers these days on this cast, in your guys' opinions, do you think, like, for whatever your next title will be after Cornerstone, do you think you will return to Kickstarter or, like, Early Access Greenlight for whatever your next game will be?
Greenlight, probably.
Of course, Greenlight.
But Kickstarter, we're not so sure. Like, there's so much work that goes into making Kickstarter video and the whole campaign and everything.
Yeah, and early access, it really depends on the genre of the game. Some games are really good for early access. I would say free playtesting, which is it's weight in gold for any indie.
Definitely.
So, even though people might be annoyed by it, it's like it really helps the game out. So if it's like a genre that can be helped by early access, it's really a good idea. Mm-hmm. But if it's like a really story heavy game, we probably shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Put
it but in there's early also access. There's also a lot of promises being made during a Kickstarter for like the for the like the different like.
The stretch goals,
backer levels and stuff.
Oh yeah, the fulfillment side too, especially.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, like,
and just that part is huge because, like, to make an interesting Kickstarter, you need to promise like interesting stuff, mm-hmm. and just like dealing with that part is like a huge process that takes you away from actually making the game, because you need to like get people involved in like in a way.
Yeah, and. I spoke to another podcast guest earlier in 2015 on that very topic of the challenges of fulfillment and all the little things that can get in the way from, you know, the design stage through manufacturing to finally actual shipping out to consumers. And that's one thing that a lot of developers can slip up on. If you don't properly plan that out, as you're saying, you know, that can kill you with shipping costs, or maybe you made something so extravagant that the cost of making it completely outweigh the cost of the Kickstarter pledge. But
exactly.
But yeah, there's so many little facets of what goes into like a Kickstarter campaign that has definitely worn a lot of people out. I've spoken to a lot of developers. Some of them, you know, they are enthusiastic. They'll do Kickstarter every time once they get that plan down. But for others, it is just a lot of work. And more importantly, it's a lot of work that gets taken away from the game. Like,
Exactly, the
best Kickstarters are the ones that you basically stop working on your game for like 3 to 4 months just to make sure you have the Kickstarter done. And even then, it's still no guarantee that it's going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the worst part
in the Kickstarter. It takes away so much work from actually making the real game to just like all this like community stuff around the Kickstarter and stuff. So.
I think the future will have more like early access models where like indies have their own like pre-purchase the game system and it won't really go through this campaign style thing where you have which you have in Kickstarter because it's so much like you said, it's such a big effort.
Yeah. And we're seeing developers and we're seeing other platforms try to make use of that. There was, of course, the big announcement of Fig, which, as a complete coincidence, is also a part of, like, Double Fine's thing. I think Tim Schafer's, like, on the board of it, where instead of pledging money for, you know, specific stretch goals, or I'm sorry, specific rewards, you can pledge money to try to get, like, stock and earnings in the actual game. So the game sells, you actually get some kind of proceeds for it. But that's still very early in the model, and I don't think any game on Fig has actually been released yet. So at this point, it's still up in the air as to whether or not that will be, you know, the future of this kind of crowdfunding thing.
Yeah, it's like to get stock, I think you have to get over a really high threshold, right?
Yeah, I think it's like the initial things like... I think it's different depending upon the company or the game, but I've saw like a $500 buy-in for one, I think.
Yeah, so I'm looking maybe in the future when transaction costs are a lot lower, maybe through like cryptocurrency and whatnot, we will be able to crowdfund things like and have stock options like at really low costs. But at this point, when transaction costs are so high, you have to have those really insane thresholds, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be amazing to buy stock for a dollar, but...
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
You can't.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one other point I want to touch on that you guys brought up about the early access, that's one other interesting part that I've talked about on previous casts and would post on the site about how certain games are the best fits for early access compared to others. You really need... Oh, yeah. And more importantly... If you try to make a game that doesn't fit early access, that can hurt you in the long run. If you have, you know, your entire audience play your 8-hour or your, you know, 3-4-hour story-driven game, and they all finish it, then they're not going to come back to keep testing it and making sure, you know, your improvements are actually working on the game.
Yeah,
that's the dangerous part. Like, I even do that with some, like, early access games. I try them out, and then I feel like I played it, and then... I stop playing it and I won't play it again because I feel like I already played it.
Yeah.
So like in the games that I think gains the most from being early access is games that are most like toy-like.
Definitely.
Besiege, for example. It's more like small patches where you get like more and more stuff, but you're basically just playing in the same area or the same place. Mm-hmm. Still.
Yeah. I think like maybe roguelikes fall into the same category. I think payment models might be responsible for what genres will be made in the future.
Yeah, and like the sandbox and roguelike games, where there is a reason to keep coming back to play them, are definitely good fits for early access.
Yeah.
Like I recently played Factorio, which was, I believe it was officially put onto Steam like earlier, I think it was either late 2015 or early 2016. And again, when you have a game that's like a collection of systems like that, then there's always more reason to come back. Because if someone says, oh, we're going to add in a new wheel or a new part, that completely affects the entire game. Versus if you're making like a story-driven game, say, oh, we fix the bugs here, that's not going to convince anyone to come back and replay an entire 4-hour campaign again.
Yeah. And it's nice to have like software that's constantly changing, so you can come back to it and have something completely new. But you already paid for it, so it's just a bonus treat. So yeah, it's a nice model, I think.
Yeah. All right. I think with that, I think we're just about out of questions, at least that I have for you guys today. So to start to wrap things up, I have just some general questions regarding Cornerstone for people listening to the cast. So, I guess the first one is, obviously we said the game is going to be due out on April, was it 23rd or 26th?
26.
26, got it. And when the game is released, it is going, I just want to clarify, it is just like the full version. There's not going to be, you know, more content or more stuff coming down the line, or is that stuff still up in the air at the moment?
we have the roguelike part of the game that is not going to be on release.
Okay. And what's the roguelike of the game going to be about?
It's about... just getting through a bunch of like levels and like reaching the final boss, basically. It's mostly like combat combat based.
It's like a trial system, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's in Cornerstone right now is mainly going to be the open world, the puzzle solving stuff like that.
Yeah, an action adventure.
Okay.
With light RPG elements, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the game is going to be released on Steam. Are you shooting, or is it going to be available on any other platforms?
It's on Steam, Good Old Games, Humble Store, I think, eventually. Mm-hmm. But I'd say look for... Yeah.
Yeah, Humble Store, too.
All right.
We're not Mac really PC sure. Linux. Like Phoenix knows more about that. We haven't really talked about what platforms, but we know for sure that we have Steam. We have their, like, Phoenix, their own, like, site. You could buy it there too, and then you have the Good Old Games one.
Awesome. All right. I guess with that, my final, I guess, question for you guys before we say goodnight for today's cast then is, do you have any, like, final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening to the cast?
Try the game out.
Demo's available now.
Yeah, it is. Like, we have demos, so, like, anyone could try it out. Even if they don't buy the whole game.
All right.
So just try it out and see if you like it.
Great. So I think with that, we're going to wrap things up for today's episode. Jonathan and Samuel, it's been a pleasure talking to you guys. Obviously, we're recording this before the release of Cornerstone, but I do wish you guys the best of luck when the game comes out.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure over here, too.
Not a problem. Hopefully... we can have you guys back on again in the future to talk about how Cornerstone did and whatever your next project may be.
Yeah, sure. We would love that.
Awesome. All right. So with all that said, we're going to wrap things up for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As we said, Cornerstone should be out by the time you're listening to this. There'll be a link to it in the podcast notes below. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. I'm always looking for new guests to come on and talk about the industry and design. To support the Patreon campaign in order to keep Game Wisdom going and keep it going ad-free, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking that little Patreon banner on the front page. Any donations would be greatly appreciated as it will all go towards making Game Wisdom better. Last but not least, you can find me on Twitch and Twitter under GWBicer to get the latest updates when new content goes live. And that also includes the Twitch and YouTube channels, which you can find me on Twitch under GWBicer, YouTube under just Game Wisdom. There you'll find streams, Let's Plays, and video supplementals to many of the game reviews here. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.
Goodbye.